Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a number of tracks that mean something to them and mark moments of their life. From that track that they first heard, the first track that the night have brought, a number of tracks that mark moments in their life, and one track that they'd like to pass on to others to give hope to the future. Today I'm joined by Mike Brace, former Paralympic skier, just to name one of his sporting achievements. He was also chief executive of Vision 2020 and part of the team that brought the Olympic and Paralympic Games to London in 2012. Hello, Mike, and welcome to Tracks of My Life.
Oh, thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
How hard was it for you selecting your tracks?
It was quite difficult, certainly trying to limit it to just a few, because there have been so many important tracks that have so much meaning throughout my life, and trying to select just a few was really quite difficult.
Well, the first track we're going to start with is a track that I think was your mum's favourite track, which is As Long As He Needs Me by Shirley Bassey. And I think your mum played a real important role in your early life. She was there supporting you and helping you to come to terms with your sight loss, and also battled on your behalf on many occasions.
Yeah, that's right. I had a firework accident on the 2nd of November 1960. So very dramatic, very traumatic. Difficult for me, obviously, dealing with things on a day-to-day basis, but massively, even probably more difficult for my family, because they had all the thinking and the feeling around it, whereas I just had to get on and deal with it. And my mum really was the driving force then. She took up the cudgels on my behalf. She battled about services or lack of them. And she really was very, very important at that time in giving me the support. And the song that she used to have and occasionally sing along to, As Long As He Needs Me, was very, I suppose, poignant at the time, because that's what she felt. She would be there as long as I needed her.
And it's a lovely track as well. Shirley Bassey has a wonderful voice, fabulous singer.
Yes, and obviously it was just playing on the Danset record player or on the radiogram when we got one, and it was just always there in the background.
Shirley Bassey there with As Long As He Needs Me, a wonderful voice by Shirley Bassey. The school that you went to as a boy, it was a special school for visually impaired people?
Yes, in those days, I don't think really there were many choices really. And that was itself pretty difficult. I was an East End boy, very much into various networks, playing out, playing football, playing sport, run-outs, go-karts in those days, all sorts of things outside in my community. And then suddenly I was going to a partially sighted school and wasn't really able to cope with that. So got sent off to a special school, the other side of London, and a boarding school at that. And for me, that was massively difficult, because that all the norms, all the things that you could relate to as someone that could see, who had then lost their sight, were also then taken away. Your room, your bedroom, you're sharing a room with other boys, your lessons are very, very differently. I mean, I was allowed really to do braille lessons for the first 6 months at the school, because I obviously couldn't read, write, etc. Adequately, and needed to have the braille skills, which I'm really, really grateful for 60 years later. But for me, you know, it was drudgery, really. It was, you know, why aren't I doing the things that anyone else is doing and just plodding through my brow class? And then they said you could sit this exam to go to a boarding school in Worcester. And I thought, God, you know, it's bad enough being the other side of London, but let alone somewhere called Worcester that sounded, you know, hundreds of miles away, it probably was. And for me, I just thought, no, I've had enough, really. So I didn't pass the exam, which I'm still probably grateful for, and basically then started to find my way with doing the sport at the school and the folk group and everything else. So suddenly life started to become a lot easier and a lot more enjoyable.
We now move to those teenage school years.
Oh dear.
At school, you not only got involved in many sports, but you also formed a folk band with some of your mates. And I believe your folk band was a little bit left ball, as not only did you sing, but you also played the clarinet, a bit of a strange instrument for a folk band.
Yes, I think that was probably a good summary of it. Basically, I was really not able to get on with guitar and things like that, but I'd started to play the recorder and silly things like that. So blowing things was a lot easier for me. And then one of the teachers in the school basically said, you know, we were setting up a music sort of club type thing, and we used to do stuff in music lessons. So we started the singing and looking at various rhythms. And then they got a clarinet and said, we were looking at anyone that wants to try to play the clarinet. So basically that was me. I then said, yeah, I'll have a go at that. And then I joined the folk group. And then basically, what are you going to do then? I needed to play something. So penny whistle and the clarinet seemed to be the obvious answers, plus the bongo drums. But it was just fantastic. It was just a piece of, I don't know, chemistry, really. I just loved, A, the noise, but B, some of the music. And one of the artists around that time was, of course, the great Acker Bilk. And so I already had someone in the public arena that was playing a clarinet that basically I could aspire to.
The next track you have selected is Dew Ball by Peter, Paul and Mary. Was that a track that you played in your band? And did you at the time think that you might be the next Peter, Paul and Mary?
I think we had aspirations. I think we thought we would probably be more like the Seekers, because they were really coming on the scene in a sort of big way around that time. And Stew Ball was, you know, one of the first songs that we picked up and sung with. We had a guy that played the drums. We had a guy that played the guitar, and then we had a girl singer come and join us, Jenny, who played the double bass. So we actually had three men and a woman in the group, and basically it was an amazing experience. I mean, it was really, really fantastic doing all of the creative stuff, but more importantly, it was a massive, easy way of getting out of school lessons, because any visitors came, we were trotted out to play for them. We were then taken out to old people's homes to sing to them, etc., etc. And so from our point of view, it was just a fantastic opportunity to do something other than the day-to-day schoolwork. And the school had a stage, so we could, you know, rather big-headedly, we then would give concerts to the rest of the pupils there, either at break time or in the evening on the stage with the four of us performing.
Oh, Stewball was a racehorse, and I wish he were mine. He never drank water.
That's a wonderful track there, Peter, Paul and Mary with Stewball. You continued with the clarinet, which your mum, I think, helped you to buy. And your next track is that fantastic clarinet player Acker Bilk with Stranger on the Shore. Why the clarinet? Why was that such a great instrument for you?
I think it was opportunism, really. Someone produced a clarinet and said, we've got no one that can easily teach it. would anyone like to try? It was a noisy instrument, and I was probably always interested in making a bit of a noise. And so I tried it. One of the masters at the school who had a contact who basically also could teach the clarinet. So he would then take me down to these friends of his, and they would give me a clarinet lesson, which was fantastic given that no one in the school could do it. And then what we started to do was to build that into not just the folk playing, but I remember playing things like Moonlight Serenade and stuff with the music master accompanying it on the organ and stuff like that. And that really did sound quite good. And the clarinet really did have major links, really, because obviously I got my mum to buy me one, which was fantastic and quite expensive in those days. And then subsequently to that, I suppose I must have been in my 20s living back at home. Things were not very good money-wise, and my mum was hard up, so I ended up selling my clarinet and giving her the money so that she could do what she needed to. And so the clarinet and Akabilk then has those memories and those linkages really with me, the good times and then some of the not so good times.
And was it really hard for you having to sell your beloved clarinet at the time?
I think it was on one level, but to be honest, because I was then at home, there was no way of playing it in, you know, with other musicians. It was really much more then of a solitary activity as opposed to contributing as part of either a group or an orchestra or anything else. So in the end, it became not redundant, but less attractive in terms of singing or doing other things. So I then started to link into a singing group and a duo that obviously helped to take things forward.
Fantastic clarinet playing there by Akabilk with Stranger on the Shore. You were playing in a folk band when you met your wife, Maureen, through a friend of a friend, which I think many of us meet our wives through a friend of a friend. And am I right in thinking that it was a love of soul music that brought you both together?
Yes, I think that was quite interesting because her friend was in this group that we formed once I'd left school with, in fact, the teacher that introduced me to folk music. And Maureen, my wife, then became the sort of groupie, really. She used to get our sandwiches and stuff when we had our group practices for her friend. And basically, we then sort of met up and started to go out. And I think she quite enjoyed the folk music, but wasn't really the sort of main part of her music sort of life. And then we both then hit on all the soul stuff that was happening around the early 70s. And basically that became something that we shared quite a lot of. We really quite enjoyed that. We have friends that we dance with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And lots of parties and things like that. And of course, the main music at a lot of the parties in those days was all the Tamla stuff and soul stuff. And therefore, it's not really surprising when we got married in 1972 that a soul track would be our sort of key songs to start the dancing with. And that was I Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye.
We heard it through the grapevine there by Marvin Gaye. And I think some people might only know that song through the jeans advert. When the folk band you were in split up, you formed a duo with the other male singer of the band, another man called Mike. Did you think of calling yourselves the Two Mikes by any chance?
That's exactly what we ended up calling ourselves. We weren't very imaginative, I think. And obviously, the two of us singing many of the songs that we'd sung in the other previous groups were obvious ones to pick. So the two of us were a good match. And we had some really, really great trips. A memorable one was we went up to Scotland. He just learned to drive and just passed his test, I think, 2 or 3 days beforehand. And then we drove up to Scotland. And obviously, he was pretty good at not drinking and driving, but I didn't have the same excuse because I wasn't driving. So we did have a fairly fluid trip up there, which resulted in one trip where he had imbibed a bit, and we ended up camping as soon as we could see a bit of grass to stick our car and tent on, and then got woken rather abruptly at 4 a.m. by the police because we were parked on the war memorial in the small town in Scotland. So they realised that I was blind and therefore took pity on us and gave us like 3 minutes to get dressed and get off. So we didn't get dressed. We just sat there in our underpants in the car and drove off with the tent strapped to the back. So a memorable occasion. But so Mike and I were really, really inseparable at that point. And we used to do some do's where we got paid as well, which was fantastic. Very, very strong part of my life, really, that duo and the time we spent together.
And what was it like performing in pubs and clubs, playing your songs, and you know, back then in that day?
It was quite interesting because obviously I was the sound man, so I had the two big speakers and a very amateur looking amp with the microphones on it, and that was something we had to then set up and bring with us, etc., etc. And of course, we didn't have a lot of money, so that was. Quite my responsibility was the sound and his responsibility was playing the guitar. I didn't then play the clarinet. A, I didn't have one, and B, it wasn't sort of part of our persona. So it was close harmony and that worked really well. We did quite a few gigs, went lots of pubs and stuff, not just on the Scotland trip, but other bits and pieces. It was a very, very fond part of my life. And At the time, obviously, Simon and Garfunkel were big artists. And of course, not surprisingly, we used to do more and more of their songs as almost aping this wonderful duo of singers. We were obviously trying to put our stamp on it, not to be like Simon and Garfunkel, but to be certainly good in terms of the sort of things that we were trying to do.
Yeah, which leads us into your next choice, which I have heard a recording of you and the other Mike performing. Not to say that your version is not that bad, but I think we'll go with the original, which is Homeward Bound by Simon and Garfunkel.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination.
The next track that you have chosen leads us up to the time of the London Olympic and Paralympic Games in 2012. It was an amazing time during the London 2012 Olympics and Paralympics. My wife Sarah and I did manage to get tickets to see some of the games, and we were incredibly lucky through a friend of a friend who was working for one of the major sponsors to actually get tickets to see Ellie Simmons win one of her gold medals. And we were about 3 rows up from the finish line, which was a fantastic experience. Back in that time, how was it for you sort of being part of that team that not only brought the games to London, but also made them such a fantastic success?
Well, you know, we've talked about the music side of my life, but the sporting side probably has been massively important over the years. Having gone blind when I was 10, I then used sport as really, I suppose, a major way of of adapting to my disability, and more importantly, pushing people to see your abilities and pushing myself to see my abilities. And so throughout the school, it meant that I could do my sport and I suppose raise my own self-awareness, self-belief, self-worth to a higher level. I left school and set up the Metro Sports Club and British Blind Sport, and later the Paralympic Association in the UK, because I wanted other people to have those opportunities to do the things I had done in sport. And then in 1976, I had the opportunity to trial for the Winter Paralympic Games that were going to be held in Sweden for the first time. And so I got selected and went on then to represent Britain at Paralympic skiing in six Paralympic Games. Then I became manager when I was a bit too old to ski. And so I started to manage sport both in the skiing world, but also in things like the first blind cricket team at the World Cup in India and athletics teams across in Europe, etc. So my passion for the sport was not only doing it, but then making sure others had that chance to participate and do the things that I'd done. And the third part of that was challenging perceptions, both the individual's perceptions of what they could do, but also the public's perception of what disability could do, disabled people could do. And therefore, suddenly being asked as chairman of the Paralympic Association to be involved in bringing the Paralympic Games to the UK and to London, my home city, was a massive, massive challenge, but also something I just couldn't believe had happened. And so, yes, I got asked to be on the bid team. So I was in Singapore when actually in the room when we were announced as having won the bid. I then got asked to be on the organising committee for the Games, and right the way through to 2012, I was then involved in various aspects of the organisation and the linkages and the publicity. And, you know, if you're an athlete like I was, the chance to be involved or at least witness a Games like the Paralympics were amazing, but to actually be involved in delivering them was just overwhelmingly wonderful. And you met all the sporting heroes of your youth. You met so many inspiring people right across all the different sports spectrums, but also across all the different disability groups. And you think because you've got a disability, you understand certain aspects of it. But suddenly linking in with people with learning disability or physical disabilities or amputations was really quite an education for me as well, and really extended my learning. So for me, it was just an experience I'll never, ever forget.
And the track that you have chosen is Search for the Hero by M. People. Why did you choose this track?
I think it's that whole thing about what have you done to make yourself proud, you know, and it is that theme really, that what you can offer to other people. It's not just, I mean, sport is potentially quite selfish. You're there to achieve, you're there to win. And part of the mindset has to be, I want to beat everyone else and I want to be the best. But at the same time, when you're then delivering some of those sporting things, what you want to say is, I want to provide people with those opportunities to be the best and to understand what drives them and what they get from sport and what they then can offer as a result of that. And so for me, it was quite important. And that track really did sum up all of that thing. So making people think about what they can offer and what they're going to do, taking things forward.
The amazing voice of Heather Small with Search for the Hero by M. People. I think that in this time that we are in at the moment, we all need something to search for. Life is not easy for anybody at the moment. So tell me, what is this track that you have chosen to pass on and give hope for the future, and why have you chosen it?
The track I'd like to pass on would be Stand By Me by Benny King. And for me, it really conjures up a lot of the things that I do hold quite dear to me. I've had some amazing opportunities, and a lot of those opportunities, whether it be in work, which obviously was important as a social worker, I ended up as an assistant director in social work, the sporting opportunities that I've had, the music opportunities I've had, and many of the life opportunities I've had, I've largely been enabled by other people, you know, the guides that have enabled me to ski or canoe or do my marathons or whatever, the people that have given me a job that that they wouldn't necessarily have thought a blind person could do in terms of social work, etc. A lot of the people out there have put a lot of faith and trust into me. And I think friendship and the sort of bond that you have, the trust, is a very, very key element of that. And therefore, Stand By Me is something that I hope they would sing and rely on me to stand by them.
Well, Mike, thank you very much indeed for joining me today for Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Great pleasure, and thank you very much for asking me.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see,